Welcome to the first Rampancy podcast session. I'm Trinicut.
And I'm Narcogen, webmaster of Bungie fansite Rampancy.net.
Today we're going to be covering the first two levels of Halo, Arrival and Sierra 117. Narcogen, what was your first impressions of the Halo 3 opening cutscene, Arrival?
Just to repeat what we've been talking about before we did the podcast, some people were, I think, a bit confused. Halo 2 ends, of course, with the Chief aboard Truth's Forerunner Dreadnought, which is arriving at Earth in the midst of a battle in orbit. And here the first thing we see is this fireball streaking across the sky, and then a small fireball that splits off while Cortana does her little monologue about luck, about why she chose Master Chief. And some people wanted to know, well, why would the Master Chief jump off this ship? And that's not covered within the game. And then we see him in the jungle floor, and Sergeant Johnson is already there. And there's a question of, well, how did he get there so quickly? How long has Master Chief been there? And people, I think, have to remember that these are necessities for, you know, for how the game is going to start. That they're not, Bungie's not going to spend an awful lot of screen time explaining how we get into the first gameplay situation. For whatever reason, I think they decided that whatever happens to the Chief on that ship is not very, it was not going to be something that was going to be enjoyable to play. And furthermore, that for him to just stay on the ship, hidden, and arrive with Truth, well, that's going to make the game far too short. I mean, the Halo 3 ultimately becomes this, the first half of it is this journey of tracking Truth down. And of course, this allows him to separate the Chief again from his goal by at least four levels. You know, you've always been chasing somebody. Since Halo 2, you've been chasing one prophet or another somewhere. And so they force you into that. The other thing they try to do with it, with the Chief prone on the jungle floor there, is try to get across a little bit of the idea that there's some real danger to characters here. I don't think anybody was going to be fooled, anybody was going to believe the Chief was dead at the beginning of Halo 3. I think if they'd killed the Chief off in the first cutscene and let you play the whole game as the Arbiter, I think there'd be some people upset. But it is a foreshadowing of the fact that, you know, there are some permanent consequences for certain characters in this game.
Having gotten the game, I think a lot of us played through on Heroic first, but when we played on Normal today, we found that, like the other two Halos, there is a configuration type walkthrough at the very beginning of the level that's only there on Normal or Easy, and not there on Heroic or Legendary.
Yeah, I think they've made each of those progressively simpler and less intrusive as the series has gone on. Halo 1 sequence really is the longest. It asks you to look up and down. It asks you to look left and right. It repeats itself. It asks you about inversion. It gives you a chance to invert the controls. And then you see here in Halo 3, if you start the game on Heroic or Legendary, you don't see anything at all. I think they assume that experienced players who are going to start playing on that difficulty have already, you know how to configure their controls and know what they're comfortable with. Even if you do see it, as we just did, it's only looking up and down, only a couple of times. It doesn't ask you about inverting your controls. You know, you could invert them there if you wanted to, because you can change your controls in-game, just like you can in Halo 2, and which you cannot in Halo 1. But I think it's also very clear that they are expecting that people who are playing this game, that most of them will have played the previous two, and so there are going to be elements that they're familiar with, and some things that they don't necessarily need to go through with for most players. But if you start up a new profile and you start off on Normal or below, that you will at least have that chance.
Absolutely. And the other main difference between Heroic and Legendary, only on the first level, is that you don't start off with any grenades, and you don't find any grenades until the first Pelican encounter.
Yes, and you had pointed that out, and I hadn't noticed that. All I had remarked on was that the Arbiter mentions that there are grenades there. He says something to the effect of, grenades, blow them to pieces. And I thought it was a little weird, because I had grenades up until that point, and there had been grunts dropping grenades up until that point, and so I always thought, well, maybe there's a pile of grenades we're supposed to explode, so I wasn't really sure what was going on there the first time I played it.
I'm going to go back here and point out one of the biggest eye-openers, and it's something that you'd sort of adjust to pretty quick, but when you first play the game, the graphics, the detail and the lighting of the jungle canopy and the foliage is just unbelievable, especially compared to the other two games.
Yeah, there really is an incredible amount of detail in the foliage of this jungle. There's no environment really quite like that in Halo 2. You can look at some of the Delta Halo outdoor environments, like on Delta Halo or on Uprising, and yeah, there's some rocky, forested areas, but there's nothing with this level of detail. And there's been no environment with that much water in it since the opening scenes of 343 Guilty Spark, which is also very similar. A dark area with a lot of trees and a lot of things going on. I remember one of the developers saying that 343 Guilty Spark was the hardest level in Halo 1 to get down into the memory requirements because of the amount of things in the environment, the trees and the insects and all these
other fog.
Yeah, the fog, all those other effects. That even though it's not a level with a lot of encounters, it's not a level with a lot of enemies, until you reach the flood, there's really not a lot of challenge in that level. But still, it was the one that pushed the console the hardest, and it was mainly about generating atmosphere. Regarding Halo 3, after I got the game, I really found it difficult to reconcile all the complaints that were coming from some of the reviewers about, well, this is barely next generation, that this doesn't look more detailed. I really couldn't figure out what they were talking about, and perhaps that's because I'm not viewing this on a high definition set. I do my gaming on a projector whose highest native resolution is what they call EDTV, or extended definition. It's 576p, so it's a little bit lower than that 720p target level that Microsoft said all of its, that it was shooting for in this generation. It's still lower than Halo 3's native resolution, which we know now is 640p. And, of course, it's much higher than the native resolution of a normal video DVD, which is 480p. So I'm looking at it a little in a strange way. The Xbox is generating 640p. Halo 3 is generating that resolution. It is upscaling it to 720p, and then my projector is downscaling it to 576p for display. But even through all of that, I found it difficult to say that the graphics in Halo 3 were that much inferior to Gears of War. Gears of War has a lot of detailed objects in it as well, but most of them are not movable. A lot of them are in the distance, and you can never go to them. And every time you finish an encounter in Gears, the area behind you is closed off. So the engine only has to deal with a small area that your encounter is in at a time. You can't ever backtrack. And so I think it's much easier for them to have a lot of detailed objects. Even so, I didn't see that the game suffered in comparison to, say, Bioshock or Gears of War, both of which I own and both of which I like. But I really found it hard to say that the Halo 3 didn't have the same visual fidelity. I think it's clear that it does.
Now, moving on to another something that you actually introduced me to, and that's that throughout Halo 1 and Halo 2, we never actually saw any encounters with our enemies where we don't influence their dialogue. The very first encounter in Halo 3 is of a brute chieftain telling, a brute telling his grunts to spread out and to keep searching.
True. I would say in Halo 1 and in Halo 2, most of the time, enemies are there almost for the sole purpose of engaging the player. You rarely see them doing anything other than that that's not in a cutscene. I was always struck by this, for instance, watching Cairo Station play out in Halo 2, where Lord Hood is telling you over the headphones over and over again that you've got to find the borders and you've got to repel them. But when you arrive in a room where there's a Covenant border party, they don't do anything other than stand in the middle of the room. If you wait long enough, they will stand in the middle of the room with their backs to you. they don't interact with anything. I mean, if there are Marines in the room, they will kill them. Even though elites in Halo 2 speak English just like they do in Halo 3, not just the backwards speak that was put into Halo 1 instead of a real Covenant language. But they don't speak to each other. So you have this rather curious spectacle of a group of three or four or more elite soldiers, very heavily armed, having come in through this boarding ship through the side of the space station, and then they're not doing anything but waiting for you to come into the room. They don't react. They don't seem to have their own agenda. Whereas I would say in two of the early encounters in Halo 3, they go to some lengths to try and establish the idea that these enemy groups have their own agenda. Now, in some cases, that agenda is still fairly simple and straightforward, which is that they're looking for you. But they try and give you a story reason why they're doing that. So first we see that brute who tells his grunts that they're looking for something. They're out here because they know the chief is here, just like Johnson was here looking for the chief. Later on, we see the brute who is interrogating a Marine, asking him about the whereabouts of the chief. And again, you can see that these are there to present the idea that these people have orders that yes, they relate to you, but they're taking some active steps to carry those out instead of just standing around waiting for the chief to show up so that they can shoot at you.
I also found that once they knew where I was, I'd have to find another place to come out of because they'd position themselves to overpower me. If I came out, they'd just blow me to bits. You need to actually think about it and find another way around it because when they know that you're there, they will put themselves in that position of power and use it to the best of their advantage.
Yes, they will do. And I'd say you see that more in some of the later encounters. I know there's been criticisms of Halo 3 that says that units don't pursue you when you retreat and that they stay too close to their spawn points. But I think there's two reasons for that. One is that having this game is basically about, facing almost impossible odds. And at the higher difficulty, you're not even as tough as your Marines. Just like in Halo 2, on Legendary, they can take more damage than you can before you die, even though you're supposed to be this Barton super soldier. So if the enemy that not only is more powerful than you and more numerous than you also was willing to pursue you relentlessly, even as you retreat, the game simply wouldn't be very much fun. I mean, you need to be able to get yourself some respite when you want it. You need to be able to go around a corner and let your shields recharge and forage around for some ammunition. If the brutes and the grunts were going to pursue you, say, from wherever they spawn all the way back to the beginning of the level, I mean, it's very... it's quite clear that a lot of people would be dying far more often than they do and may get frustrated and not finish playing the game. I think that some of the developers mentioned that a fairly significant portion of people who buy a $60 or $100 AAA title, that a lot of them still don't finish it. And that's why there is such a wider range of difficulties available in Halo 3, where you've got, Legendary is pretty hard, but you've also got Heroic and Normal, and below that you've got Easy. I mean, Normal to a lot of people is easy. And then, of course, there's also the skulls that you can throw in there to modify that and make things harder or easier for yourself.
The scale of encounters, they're much larger than what they were in Halo 2 and Halo 1. But we'll look closely at the last encounter that you have. I know it took you a little bit to do because for some reason you had 5 or 6 skulls on in your normal run.
I chose normal because I just wanted to blow through the level just to keep all the encounters fresh in my mind, and I did not check my campaign settings screen. So I did have... Let me look at the list here I had up there. I did have Tilt, Fog, Mythic, Thunderstorm, Catch, I Would Have Been Your Daddy, Grunt Birthday Party, and Cowbell all on. So yes, lots of grunts carrying and throwing grenades, lots of weapon-resistant gold brutes, and of course the tiniest little explosion sets off a chain reaction that that blows units all the way across the map, and I think blew my sniper rifle away from me when I dropped it for a moment.
Yeah, so back, like, in that encounter with the sniper rifle was probably the biggest one. It's at the end. It starts off with a cutscene. You see Johnson being showing some resistance to the chieftain and being thrown into a cell. The interesting thing about that cutscene in particular is that you can cut it short. You can back out of it and continue doing what you're doing, but it actually continues to play in the background, which is something new to Halo 3. It's something
more like a scripted event, like you'd see in Half-Life 2. I mean, and they do give you that choice that you can experience that either as a regular but rather short cutscene. In other words, you can give up, you can allow the machine to take camera control and to point out what it wants you to look at and have it presented in a short cinematic way. But you can skip it, and that doesn't stop those events from happening. It doesn't stop that dialogue from happening. So then, you know, if you choose to skip that, you can experience that event as it would any scripted event in Half-Life 2, where you have full camera control, you can run what you want to do, you can pay attention to what's being said and what's going on or not. And that's also a first for Halo. And, you know, some people might say, okay, well, that's not a big deal. Half-Life 2 did that. But Half-Life 2 doesn't have a lot of cinematic presentation really at all, aside from its credit sequences and its true cutscenes, which are pretty much just the beginning and the end.
Yeah, unlike Halo 2, which has a cutscene, a decent-sized cutscene at the end and beginning of... I mean, I know the cutscene for Floodgate, at the end of Floodgate's phenomenal size. It's probably 3 or 4 minutes at the very least. I haven't actually sat down and figured out how long it is, but it's... You sit through all of that, and there's like a lot, there's hours of cutscene footage from Halo 1 and 2. I mean, the Legendary Disc has 1, 2 in high def, and how many hours, like 2 or 3 hours of cutscenes for that, is there?
There's about a little bit less than an hour of cutscene in Halo 1, and there's about an hour and a half in Halo 2. So if you look at it, I mean, just the, you know, even without the combat, you're looking at something that's almost the length of a feature film. And I found it quite interesting looking back, watching those on the Legendary Edition DVD, that as much as people like to harp on Halo 2 for its balance problems, its gameplay problems, the way there was kind of a certain lack of Bungie polish in certain areas, that the cutscenes viewed all together from beginning to end hang together as a story quite well, probably better than it does when you actually play it. And I think that may have informed some of the decisions that Bungie made with the Halo 3 cutscenes. Yes, some of them are of good length, but on balance they're shorter, and things are more broken up into the shorter elements. So, for instance, that cutscene before that final one that you can skip through or rush through or ignore if you want. And also there are a couple of these little Cortana moments. And, of course, later in the campaign, the Gravemind moments. And so these also... They interrupt the gameplay to give you a little bit of story, but not too much. It's not a full-blown cutscene.
Unfortunately, you can't skip the Cortana cutscenes, which I think after playing through it a couple of times, you're sort of like, all right, I want to skip this, because it slows you down and it really interrupts your gameplay. But it doesn't have too much effect, but you've heard it once, and so you've heard it 1,000 times. So we stay here.
That's true. I can see why some people know them. Are annoyed by them, but they are very short. I have to admit, I've played through the campaign, you know, once completely on Heroic, once completely on Legendary, and then some of the levels I went back to get the Metascore achievements. And so, yes, I've seen those same scenes now a few minutes, and there is partially a reaction of like, well, I wish I could skip this, but they are quite short. I find them far less annoying than the similar events that occur in Gears of War. Gears of War, if you remember, has these also very similar sequences that are not quite cutscenes. You don't lose camera control, but your running speed is taken away down to a walk as the characters put their hands to their ears to hear Anya on the radio giving them some information, or to hear, you know, the two buddies that you left off in some other area crack some jokes to each other. And these sequences are quite a bit longer than the Cortana and Gravemind moments. And in addition to that, they also tend to occur right after checkpoints. So,
yeah.
If you die, you have to hear that again. And again,
all over again.
I'm very familiar with,
especially there's the cutscene right at the end with what's General Ram, I think it is, and you've got to go through that cutscene. I mean, if you do it on Insane, you have to go through that cutscene.
Yes. But even that one is pretty short. At the pumping station, though, where you first see the Theron guards, there's a rather lengthy conversation that ensues there. And you do have to do that over and over again, starting from, you know, I don't think I can count that high, talking about the value of the emulsion that is in this area.
Yeah.
And then, of course, where Dom asks again, you know, has the wind ever said hostiles to you? And, after a while, I was yelling at the screen, yeah, the wind says hostiles to me, you know, an awful lot, because I was just playing that moment over and over again.
Yeah, I know exactly how you feel there. Actually, well, I don't really, that particular encounter I went through on cooperative in one shot. It was just a really lucky go. Back to the scale of the battle, the final encounter of Sierra 117, the scale is much, much larger than any other game.
Sure. I mean, you get some things there that you didn't get to see before. I mean, you get to see Pelicans and Phantoms actually engaging in combat that you could participate in. Instead of just being able to shoot the turrets, you know, there are these manable turrets on the sides of the Phantom that have gunners, and you can shoot them. If you've watched a saved film, you can actually see the enemies spawning inside this and coming out, and you could throw a grenade in there if you wanted. And in addition to just being bigger, they're a lot less linear. I mean, there are several ways you can approach that. You can hang back and you can snipe a lot. If you go down onto the ground, there are a couple of ways you can get across the bridge. You can walk up on the front. You can walk around the side. There's a tunnel underneath. And, of course, the enemies can use that as well. I mean, a couple of times I got flanked from one side by an enemy who had come in down through the tunnel and then climbed up and gotten in behind me.
The size of the encounters in Halo 3 are considerably larger. I mean, even with the small ones, in Halo 1, you'd have a single elite, and I think it was two or three grunts and a couple of jackals was sort of some of the largest encounters that you'd see. In Halo 3, you've got, even the very first encounter is a brute with about seven grunts underneath him, and shortly down the track, there's about twice that with a pelican drop-off and another group coming from the path that you're about to go through.
Yeah, I think one thing that the technical improvements in terms of the improvements that are made on the Xbox 360 as compared to the Xbox One in terms of the amount of memory and everything is that Bungie, I think, had the freedom with this installment that they could bring in enemy reinforcements when they decide that for dramatic and story purposes, they want there to be reinforcements. Whereas in Halo 2, if you look at it, that mechanism was really used to generate an encounter that would be challenging to the player. Again, look at something like a Hangar Bay Number 2 in Cairo Station. It doesn't really make much sense for, at regular intervals, half a dozen grunts and two or three elites to be coming out of this boarding craft. You know, it just makes everything seem so arbitrary. You know, if there are 30 guys in that boarding craft, you'd figure they'd all come out at once to fight you, and that would give them the best chance of beating you. Instead of, you know, like the combatants in a kung fu movie, coming at you one at a time so that you have a chance. That's what they're able to do in Halo 3 now, is that if they want to give you that large an encounter, they can do it all at once. They can have reinforcements come in if they want, but it's really up to their choice. They don't have to do it to break it up because, for whatever reason, they can't have that many actors on screen or they can't have that many AI units in one room.
And a not-so-subtle change from Halo 1 and 2 is that the Marines are actually really useful now. So if you've got a lot of brutes really trying to kill you there, having a Marine with a rocket launcher on the back of your mongoose riding Brokeback in some of the latter missions, or if you just have a six or seven Marines with you when you have the final encounter on Sierra 117, it makes a lot of difference. You know, they're not just sponges like they were in Halo 2. They really are an asset.
you know, that's just an eventuality that comes of having to balance this thing out. I mean, in order to make the higher levels a real challenge for the player, one of the easiest levers that Bungie has to deal with is the damage model. You know, how much damage do your enemies take? How much do they deal out? And so, yeah, that does end up, you know, creating some strange situations where, you know, your Marine allies who shouldn't really be as tough as you, turns out they are tougher than you. And because if they weren't, they wouldn't last long enough. Even as it is, I would say, on Legendary Halo 2, you know, Marines do not last long. They're simply not smart enough to live very long, and they're not aggressive enough to do much damage. I would say one thing that is true of both Halo 2 and Halo 3 is that kind of the cinematic experience sweet spot really is heroic. Legendary is there as a personal challenge, but just like in Halo 2, you know, you're going to find yourself fighting alone, going to the last bullet in the gun, and not having the same kind of experience playing as you would on Heroic, especially when it comes to Marines driving vehicles, which we can talk about when we cover another one of the levels. There's no drivable vehicles in Sierra 117, and so the rather large group of Marines that you have with you, plus the Arbiter, you know, really are a big advantage.
Well, I'd say that would wrap up most of Sierra 117. I think we've covered everything except the actual story itself, which, well, we've started at the start of it, you know, how it comes into it. It concludes with, it's just basically a really great introduction into the new gameplay of Halo 3 and just sort of the mechanics of the game compared to Halo 2 is sort of more evolved. The storyline doesn't really thicken, though, this particular mission.
I do think they do something important with the storyline in terms of trying to integrate the gameplay into the storyline. Where, you said again, you know, most enemy units in any one of these games are there solely for the purpose of engaging the player, and that is true here. But what they try to do in that level that they didn't always do in Halo 2 or Halo 1 is try and give that an in-story explanation. So that final scripted event that we see when the Arbiter points out that the Brutes are imprisoning Johnson and that this is a trap, well, that all brings it back. You know, they're not just, you know, you're constantly having your teammates captured and having to rescue them, but at least now they pointed out they're after the Master Chief. They want to draw the Master Chief. They kidnapped Johnson specifically for the purpose of drawing the Chief's attention because he is their real target. And it's nice to have them pay that attention.
Yeah, it's definitely a really nice improvement to Halo 3. With that, I think we might conclude. Well, for me, it's this evening. It's about 9 o'clock at night. It's different for you in Afghanistan. But I think we might draw a conclusion to this podcast today. We'll probably be having another one soon. Anyone who's listening to this, focusing on, of course, the next level. And because, you know, and this is one we've covered a lot of the really new additions to Halo 3, we're going to try and cover some of the multiplayer aspects, the saved films in Forge, and the Bungie.net changes, of course, the Skulls, which we briefly touched on today, and we soon come across Terminals in a few levels' time. But in the meantime, we'll hope you enjoyed this podcast. No, right. Anything else to add?
No, I think that's it. I think we've covered that quite well, and hopefully we'll have plenty more to talk about in the next installment also.
See ya.